According to a recent textbook on communications, and I mean recent, just published, right now in America there are 1,780 commercial television stations, 15,503 broadcast radio stations, 1,331 newspapers, 2 million billboards, and 5,821 movie theaters. Worldwide, there are 7 billion cell phone subscriptions and 1.6 billion websites. And this information became obsolete by the time it took me to say these two sentences, because there will be more of the above, except for print newspapers. We're drowning in information, data, news, or fake news, and knowledge of all kinds, but there is a famine of wisdom. Solomon comes to the throne of Israel, as we heard today, in such a way that we forever link him to the concept of wisdom. People who have no knowledge of the Bible have heard the term the wisdom of Solomon, even if they can't place the character or the events that would describe why he is wise. And as we move from David to Solomon in this ongoing saga, this one we have journeyed with all summer and that I think will come to an end at some point, wisdom comes front and center. And this is sort of a topical sermon today, because as I spent time with these scriptures, these four scriptures, a common theme is the necessity of wisdom. And so we're going to talk for a bit about wisdom. Solomon is actually not the obvious successor to David. That would be Adonijah, who was Solomon's older brother. He was confident. He was influential. He had become first in line to the throne, and he seemed like the kind of person that we'd all want to lead us. But Adonijah was self-willed. He was undisciplined. He tried to take the throne for himself. You can read this in 1 Kings. He wants us, the text of 1 Kings wants us to understand that Solomon became king because God desired it. It was God's will. Yes, his mother manipulated the situation somewhat, but that wasn't the deciding factor in this. We heard several weeks ago that God loved Solomon when he was born and gave him a secret name, Jedidiah. Accession to the throne would not be by birth order or personal ambition, but in God's way, in God's mysterious way. Solomon does not become king the way so many rulers come to power, by force or political alignments or even skill at leading people. He is, in fact, the first dynastic king of Israel. Saul and David come to the throne by way of war and leadership. Solomon inherits it. And he does so because God is working within the details to bring about his will. Now, Solomon isn't perfect. In fact, he worships in places that had been seen as off limits. Remember, David brings the ark to Jerusalem to centralize the worship of God. And Solomon apparently is still carrying on with some of this other stuff that's going on. He delays in building the temple. And if we follow the arc of his life through, then we learn he's ultimately brought down because of his love for women who are foreign to Israel and to the divine covenant. But he's also a man that has his heart and desires pointed in the right direction, at least. And when given the chance to ask for anything of God in a dream, he doesn't ask selfishly, he asks for wisdom to govern well. And for this, God rewards him. So what is wisdom? What is he really asking for? You know, I think it's probably better described than defined. But here's a definition, though, from my seminary Old Testament professor, who's still teaching. Her name's Ellen Davis. She said, wisdom is living in the world in such a way that God and God's intentions for the world are acknowledged in all we do. The fruit of wisdom, a well-ordered life and a peaceful mind, results not from a high IQ, but from a disposition of the heart that the sages of Israel most often called the fear of the Lord. She also offers this. The sages of Israel teach that those who would be wise must aim not at power, but at goodness. Scott McKnight summarizes it like this: wisdom is living in God's world in God's way. Kenneth Conser, in reviewing the Old Testament's teaching on wisdom, says that it's characterized by prudence, discernment, humility, by keeping the commandments of God. It's based on the fear of the Lord, and wisdom is of inestimable value. It enables one to live a good and truly satisfying life. When we move to the New Testament, wisdom is not just a quality of living or a posture. It is personal. 1 Corinthians 1 declares that Jesus is the wisdom of God, who then becomes the source of all true wisdom for us. And that would have been a great New Testament reading for today, along with Ephesians. And I'd like to read it to us now from 1 Corinthians 1. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. The intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. That's from Isaiah. Where are the wise? Where is the teacher of the law? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand signs, and Greeks look for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. So in other words, wisdom looks like Jesus. And we find wisdom in our relationship with him. We don't have to ponder through the murky mists to try to get at some elusive nature of wisdom. We can know it directly and personally through the life, death, resurrection, and reign of Christ. I attended a clergy conference in Atlanta a number of months ago, and the speaker was Scott McKnight, our own Scott. Scott was sharing insights into wisdom in Scripture. But more pointedly, how the church can grow a culture of wisdom within it. And he's written on this in a forthcoming book, I think it's called Pastor Paul, about St. Paul as a pastor. And it is in my thoughts today. I've seen a manuscript of the book. You're going to love it when it comes out, finally. So I borrow a couple things from it, and rather than footnote everything that's Scott's, I'll just say, if I say something that is a little poetic and unclear, that's probably me. If it's pithy and direct, it's probably Scott. So. Solomon desired to have wisdom, and it was granted. The Proverbs urge us over and over again to live out of a wisdom framework. And the calling of the Christian life is to take on the shape of Christ's life and teachings, to live a wise life. That is one renewed by the Spirit of Christ. In our scriptures today, Paul tells the Ephesians to live as wise, not unwise people. He relates it in chapter 5 to sober living that's rooted in worship and thankfulness. In the gospel today, those who hear Jesus' words about the living bread that came down out of heaven begin to argue in the synagogue because they cannot accept the truth of this teaching because they do not have the wisdom of God, which can so often seem like foolishness to those living by the world's standards. So then, what are some of the marks of wisdom? Because this is a huge subject. I'm just sort of taking us in a little bit to the room where wisdom is. We've already noted some of them from the Proverbs, and here are just a couple that might have some particular resonance for us in our life, in the culture that we live in, and even in our church community. An important one is that wisdom is humble. Wisdom is humble, not proud. It listens. There's a reverence, there's a receptivity in it. In wisdom, we admit what we don't know. Wisdom leads us along a path of interest and care for the ideas of others, particularly those who we see as wise. Wisdom does not need to be the first voice in the conversation or the loudest. Wisdom is not in a hurry. It doesn't need to force others to its point of view. It just is. The fact that humility is an important quality of wisdom that is so lacking in our culture should be sort of obvious to us, even in church culture. We spend so much time and energy and money gaining knowledge, gaining information. And information is not the same thing as wisdom. Now, it's helpful and it's important. Knowledge can inform wisdom, and I think it works best that way. But it is not inherently wise in and of itself. There is no PhD in wisdom, except perhaps life itself. I actually think we could take the love chapter of 1 Corinthians 13 and relate it to wisdom. You know, it has that sort of quality to it. I mean, Paul's already set the stage here for his wisdom talk, and then he goes into this section in love, and I think it's probably because the Corinthians struggle with both those things, love for one another and wisdom. I mean, think about it. Wisdom is patient. Wisdom is kind. Wisdom does not envy. Wisdom does not boast. Wisdom is not proud. Wisdom does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. I mean, I think there's a lot that we could, where we could just sort of lay it over that. Love and wisdom have a powerful relationship, in fact. True love is personified in Jesus, as is wisdom. They have the same source. Knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. A quote attributed strangely to Jimi Hendrix. I don't know where it came from, but if you just follow it up, that's every sort of time that quote appears, it's Jimi Hendrix. So, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. One day, some of the brethren came to see Abba Antony. That's one of the desert fathers. And among them was Abba Joseph. Wishing to test them, the old man mentioned a text from Scripture, and starting with the youngest, he asked them what it meant. Each explained it as best he could, but to each one, the old man said, "You've not yet found the answer." Last of all, he said to Abba Joseph, "And what do you think the text means?" He replied, "I do not know." Abba Antony said, "Truly, Abba Joseph has found the way. For he said, I do not know." Wisdom is humble. Knowledge never allows us to say we don't know, especially in leadership. We're supposed to always know, always be sure, always talking, always filling the void, right? Wisdom is humble, but it is not passive. Wisdom calls forth truth. It calls forth justice. Wisdom seeks to stabilize and to heal and to protect. And if wisdom is fully operational, if wisdom is called on and given its role, then I think so many of the scandals and the terrible tragedies that we hear about, both in the church and in public institutions, would be avoided because wisdom would be at work. Wisdom also has a role in helping to heal those things once they happen. In fact, it needs to be present. Not just information, but wisdom. So it is humble, it's restraining, but it's not passive. That's the first mark of wisdom that I think would be helpful for all of us. The second is that wisdom takes the long view. It has a kind of a wide-angle lens on things, right? If we seek to live wisely, we will not be overly obsessed with the present moment. As so many of us are, so much of our culture is. And I think this is an element of wisdom that sometimes we don't think about. Because everything around us is screaming about what is going on right now. I mean, this is a little philosophical, but we sort of edged into this when we moved from analog time to digital time, didn't we? I'm kind of an analog person that way. So if you have, like, my watch has actually a face on it, it has hands. You know where you've been, and you know where you're going with analog, right? Digital is just now, 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 now. So philosophically, we've made a shift into just focusing on what is right now in front of us. And, you know, there's importance to that. We need to give attention to what's here. But it's not the only thing, because wisdom knows the lessons of the past And it brings to us the panorama of history and calls us to live in such a way that honors that past, even as we reach for the future. Wisdom knows that the present moment will soon be the past moment, and the future will come. Scott puts it something like this in the book. He says, wisdom leads us to live in light of what would my grandparents say, but also what will my grandchildren do? And that is, you know, sometimes we have that conversation about my grandma Lucy, who was very outspoken, just a wonderful woman, loved God, loved you. She was a gossip. So she always wanted to know all of your stuff. But if you were in a hard place in life, she was there sitting with you no matter what. I mean, it wouldn't judge you. So even today, sometimes I find myself thinking, I wonder what my grandma Lucy would think about this. But I'm also now more aware of what Owen, my grandson, will do as he grows, based on what example he is given. So much knowledge, so many of our decisions, even related to faith, are stuck in a moment, with little concern for what has come before and what will arrive later. Frederick Buechner's image is one I love. He says, it stands up to its knees in the past and keeps its eyes on the future. Stands up to its knees in the past, keeps its eyes on the future. This is the gift of years I'm talking about, and how wisdom can come from experience. Now, you know, it's not always the case. There are very wise young people, sometimes way beyond their years, and there are old fools walking around. There are. But generally, those who have earned their gray hair or their bald spots have some wisdom about the long view that we just don't have when we're younger. It's just impossible. We don't have the mechanisms yet. They've learned how to put things in perspective. So much of our life in the church would be radically altered if we just take this on, and also other aspects of wisdom in a deeper way. A recent study of churches found that pastors generally measure the success of their ministries by the following things: attendance, offering, number of programs, and square footage. That's the so-called wisdom that is driving church life for so many. And it's easy to be pulled into that. And of course, they are indicators. They are. They're not, you know, you don't want to ignore those things, but they're not the source of wisdom. They're not the substance of wise leadership. I know a pastor friend who was recently approached by a couple of members of his board and said, we think you have 1 or 2 years and then you need to retire. I mean, it's devastating to him. He's late 60s. He's actually in the prime of much of what he's doing. He's a gifted preacher, a gifted writer. He has published books. He's in good health. The church is healthy. But they just had this idea that he's approaching 70. We need to move him on. The board is taking its cues from resources that don't value this wisdom culture. This is one of the gifts that we have in our relationship to Rwanda. Rwanda is a wisdom culture. It really is. It honors the gift of years. It honors the elders. I know when I'm there and introducing myself to people, I always say I have 3 grandsons. And then usually the group goes, oh, you know. I mean, it makes a difference. I mean, I might be an upstart, but I'm an older upstart. It's true, and so we could gain so much from that. We could. So if wisdom is humble, wisdom looks at kind of the big picture in terms of years and time. How do we acquire wisdom? How do we get it? Well, it's not from a book. It's not from studying it. And it's not just from living longer either. Wisdom is something we acquire. It's something we receive if we're open to it. Wisdom is relational. It's about life with others, especially with those who are wise, who are already wise. It's handed down to us. Wisdom is not something we go off on our own to find. You know, I'm going to the Caribbean to find wisdom. You might find some other great stuff down there. I don't think wisdom, you know, it might, well, you might. Only if you enter into relationship with wise people there, though. This is one of the things I love about a multi-generational church. I don't know if you know, this is a great gift. We don't say, you know, if you're under 35, sorry, we have another church for you over here. We're all thrown together in this place. We have energy and idealism from those who are younger. Amen. But we have a huge repository of wisdom in our elders. Just look around this room. We are blessed with those who have followed the Lord for many years, who have grown in wisdom and experience, whose faith has been tested and affirmed through many situations. Last week, Randy and Alice were at our house as part of the newcomers' lunch. Randy, I don't want to like out you, but you're elder, right? You've lived a few years. Okay. Can I say? Can you say how old you are? Do you mind? '93. And to watch him interact with our grandson, Owen, who's 5, was just great. I mean, it was just a beautiful thing there. And after Randy and Alice left, I asked Owen, I said, do you know how old he is? It's probably older than you can count, except that he can count pretty high. So I think he's got that. And his eyes just got really big. You know, if you need wisdom, and we all need wisdom, then find a new friend, one who is wise, whose faith has been tested and affirmed through many situations over many years, right? Find a sage, and there are plenty here in this place. Wisdom is one of those good things that can be contagious, but we have to be in relationship for that transfer to occur. Desire to be wise. Look forward to growing older. And learn from those here who have wisdom. You know, I think that's hard in our culture to look forward to getting older. Because we fight that with everything we have. I've been doing a little fighting on that. And I know I've talked with some others of you who are struggling with some of that. And part of that is just that everything is about youth in our culture. But it's also, maybe you haven't thought about it, but as we get older, we lose our sages. Those who were mentors to us, those who we looked up to, are no longer there for us to go to say, what can I do in this? Help. And yet there's a way that we can learn to look forward to the gift of years. Wisdom is also relational at the spiritual level because it is given by the Spirit. Christ is the wisdom of God, so the more that we are changed into his likeness, the more wise we will become, the more discerning, the more humble, the more circumspect, the more faithful, and so on. Yes, it is a process of time, but time and depth in our life with God. This kind of thinking runs counter to our larger culture, as I've mentioned several times. It worships youth, it worships health, it worships physical perfection, it worships information in the present moment. One of my favorite pastors, Fred Rogers, said, life is deep and simple, and what our society gives us is shallow and complicated. I desire that we be a community of wisdom that's deep, simple. I think we're on that road, I do. And I want to see us to continue that journey, to deepen it. It will take time and intention and openness and humility and love. To close, let me share a story with you from another pastor, Reverend Gary Izzard, who wrote this and shares it. Because I think it's a picture of this. A young man once stood on a street corner, and he opened his coat and he cried, "Look at my heart! Look at my perfect, perfect heart." And a crowd soon gathered, impressed by his perfect heart. And they stood in awe of a heart without blemish. It was perfect and complete in every way. Soon an old man walked by, and he paused to see what the commotion was all about. And when he heard the young man proudly crying, "Look at my perfect heart," the old man pushed his way to the front to get a closer look. And when he saw the young man's heart, he scolded him. "Son, that is not a perfect heart. If you want to see a perfect heart, you need to see mine." And with that, the old man opened his coat to reveal an old, knotted, an ugly heart. It was full of bumps and holes, and pieces of it had broken off here and there. The crowd began to laugh, but the old man raised his hand and spoke. He said, "See this bump? That's where I met my first love. Oh, how the sun shone that day, how bright the colors of the universe were, how sweet the singing of the birds in the trees. What a wonderful moment it was. But see that hole? That is where my first love and I broke up. How it pained me and pains me still. But you know, the hole once ran much deeper. The years have managed to fill it in a lot. Not always, but some. See this bump? That's where I met the woman who became my life partner. What a wonderful life we had. Year after year of shared companionship, of laughter, tears, and joy. The scratch here is where we had a blazing row that threatened to end our marriage, but we made up and we moved on. Over here, this place where a piece of my heart is broken off, this is when she passed away. Oh, the ache, yet it still aches even today, for she took a part of my heart to the grave with her, but I trust she will return it to me someday. But here's another great bump. This is when we began our family. You'll notice the hole beside it. That's when we learned we could not bear our own children. How hard it was to accept. How painful to live with. But the bump is when we got our adopted daughter, our very own beautiful little girl, to raise as our own. Yes, there are scratches and indentations surrounding the bump. The times we fought and yelled, but we always learned to forgive, and so this bump grows even bigger. The old man went on to describe many of the other bumps and holes and scratches on his heart, and when he finished, the crowd was silent. "You see, son," he said, turning to the young man with the unblemished heart, "yours is not a perfect heart, for it is not lived. It has not been touched with joys and tears and laughter and love and pain and anguish and hardship and celebration. Only when you're old like me will you be able to look upon a gnarled and battered heart and be able to say, yes, that is a perfect heart." There is wisdom in this. May it be with us. May it be with us. Amen.